Now, when we think of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we don't necessarily think of raves, but a new documentary, Raving Iran, tells us the story of Anoush and Arish, who are part of the country's underground music scene. In a country in which electronic music is banned, deemed indecent by the religious authorities, this new documentary describes the struggle of two DJs to develop a musical career and to continually evade law enforcement. So on the line, we have the director of Raving Iran, Suzanne Moyers, to talk to us about this film. Welcome to the show.
Hello from Zurich.
Oh, excellent. I really thought this isn't just a film about electronic music. I also thought it was really about the young generation of Iran and, you know, really trying to sort of break free from, you know, the sort of fetters of...
Indeed. Yes, it's, I wouldn't call it a music documentary. It is definitely much more, it's much more about, you know, the young generation, as you said, about politics and basically a very forked media image which we have of Iran, which I've been trying to unveil.
Yeah, so now your film is almost gives us an almost fly-the-wall perspective of those involved in the underground music scene attempting to, you know, remain, you know, one step ahead of the authorities. So where did you get the idea of this documentary?
I think about 5 or 6 years ago, I read like a two sentences about techno parties in the Persian desert. Mm-hmm. I think in Vice magazine, if I remember rightly. And that was kind of the start. I saw it and I actually thought immediately that would be an amazing film topic. I wasn't looking for, you know, doing a documentary, like a feature length documentary on techno parties. But it was, for me, it was a great start. I could just feel that was probably a possibility to actually look at something which we know very little about, which is the young generation in Iran.
So tell us a little bit about how you filmed this. I mean, I'm assuming this is mainly done using mobile devices, you know, I'm assuming to prevent sort of detection from the authorities.
Let's say it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
First of all, it's pretty hard to get into the country. I mean, especially if you go more than once. And I was always traveling on a tourist visa. And I was very lucky. I mean, I went, I think, 6 times in total. And I stayed 1 to 2 months every time. And they did actually give me a tourist visa every time. And I think it's because I was applying from Switzerland. And then, of course, like, you know, there were a thousand problems. I was facing, first of all, I mean, I couldn't stay anywhere. I couldn't stay in a hotel, you know, me alone as a woman, also for, you know, such a long time, every time. Then if you stay in a hotel, of course, everyone can get into the room. So I couldn't, you know, leave my equipment there. So I actually had to find people who, you know, would accommodate me. And I didn't know anyone in Iran. So I think just like the basics, they were already quite hard to kind of organize. And then, of course, you know, equipment, I couldn't take a camera. So in the end, I decided to shoot on a tourist camera and also on an iPhone. And what I did basically, I mean, I used memory cards, for example. I mean, that was like one of the many means of kind of trying to prevent any, you know, any problems. I had memory sticks, memory cards with tourist pictures, and I had memory cards for the film footage, which I, you know, kept swapping around every time we got caught. We were stopped by the police. You know, I had my tourist pictures in. I was kind of trying to kind of be the normal tourist in their eyes. And I guess another big thing was, of course, to try and get the footage out of the country. And what I did in the end, I encrypted hard drives, and these hard drives I smuggled out of the country with Iranian students who were, you know, studying somewhere in the world. And then from wherever they were studying, I couriered these hard drives back to Switzerland.
So it's almost like the famous Jafar Panahi, who smuggled out a film of his called "This Is Not a Film" on a memory stick. I think he hid it in a cake or something. If I remember rightly, that was a really, really clever way of getting it out of the country. I mean, I really liked. I mean, I thought that the film we had, particularly that first 20 minutes, it really sort of projected a real sort of claustrophobic impact as the ravers are sort of trying to evade the sort of law enforcement. Was that really sort of thought out the way that you sort of got those aesthetics that way?
Sorry, say again.
Just a lot of close-ups. It really gave a real claustrophobic feel and a lot of movement. But that first 20 minutes, you know, was that a real like aesthetic decision, or was that just because you were shooting on the fly and it sort of just turns out that way?
I mean, of course, like especially the first 20 minutes, we were shooting a lot indoors. So I think that is actually adding to the claustrophobic feel. And it was definitely something which I also wanted to, when you see the movie, I mean, I have a lot of window shots when the boys are looking out. So it gives you this feel of, you know, being jailed. Yeah, it was definitely an intention, you know, of mine to create this feel, if this is what you mean.
Yeah, so I mean, what I've thought was really interesting also is, you know, just how aware sort of the public is of, you know, the sort of hypocrisy of many of the prohibitions. You know, I think that's really exemplified in the surreal visit to, was it the Office of Culture and Islamic Guidance?
And exactly, ministry, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, you've got this band. I mean, the DJs, they call themselves Blade and Beard, and they turn up to this office and they're told that there's all these prohibitions. They're not allowed to have a female lead singer, and they've got to be veiled. And you even get a feeling that, you know, one of the girl that's getting interviewed, that even she seems to be aware of some of the absurdity of some of the prohibitions.
Yes, I think so too. I think they actually do meet and face quite a few officials in the film, and I think it comes across quite nicely that that like even people who are employed by the state, that they don't quite believe in what they're doing or what they're being told to do. Yes, absolutely.
So this is getting screened. It's already been screened, I believe, in Toronto and Munich. I was wondering, you know, has the film resonated with the Persian diaspora in those cities?
Yeah, I mean, the film's been, I have to say, I'm very grateful. The film's been super successful. It's been running at over 100 festivals, and it was the most successful documentary in German cinemas in 2016. And it was actually, I think it was aired on Iranian satellite TV a few weeks ago, and a lot of, you know, exiled Iranians have actually seen the film. And I mean, so far, yeah, I only got like incredible positive feedback, I have to say. I mean, even handwritten letters, you know, people started to thank me, and it's been really good.
It's also a really good look at sort of counterculture and how music really can play an impact in you know, in really challenging the sort of rigid hierarchies.
Yes, absolutely.
So how did you find these underground ravers? I mean, how did you end up getting contact with these, you know, fantastic protagonists?
Well, it wasn't easy. Well, after I had the idea to make a film about this, I signed up on Facebook and I tried to infiltrate the scene from Europe, basically. And so via Facebook, I got in touch with lots of young people in Tehran, and which, to be honest, like really didn't lead me anywhere. It didn't go anywhere. So a few weeks later, I just got on a plane and I went to Tehran and tried to meet these young people in person. Again, it wasn't easy. And then I think in the end, I met about 30 to 40 people, and basically no one wanted to be part of the film, obviously, for obvious reasons. And it was just Anush and Arash who really, in the end, I think they were the last ones I met, who immediately said yes. But then they did say yes, but I have to say, like, throughout the filming, throughout the shooting, they cancelled the filming every other day because they thought it's going to be too dangerous. So I have to say, right until the end of actually producing the film, I never knew if the film would actually turn into a film. So it was pretty nerve-wracking, the whole project.